This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Yak Gadget, made in America, based outside of Nashville, Tennessee. Yak Gadget offers all kinds of storage accessories, quick mount motor mounts, anchor systems, track mounted accessories, even paddles. Go to yakgadget.com and get your kayak decked out for your next trip out on the water.
The 153 Bait Company, based in Troy, Ohio, make everything from plastics to custom painted hard baits. Hook them hard and hook them off. All of our baits are made to order and all of our hard baits are hand painted to order. So go to the153anglers.com to place your order today.
This segment is brought to you by Jigmasters. Step up your game with high-quality performance jigs, spinnerbaits, buzzbaits, and more from Jigmasters.com. And always, when in doubt, get the jig out.
You're listening to Bass Fishing for Noobs, the Paddle and Fin Podcast, with your hosts Ryan Milford and Sean Lambert.
Welcome back to the Bass Fishing for Noobs segment on the Paddle and Fin Podcast.
What podcast?
Paddle. I'm your host, Sean Lavery. With me, as always, is my good buddy, Ryan Milford. Welcome, Ryan.
What's up, man?
Tonight on the new show, we'd like to welcome Chris Gorsuch from Real River Adventures. He's a guide local to me here in PA on Susky. Welcome, Chris.
Glad to be here, guys.
So, Chris, for anybody who doesn't know you or isn't from my neck of the woods or hasn't seen your awesome Facebook page, tell the folks a little bit about yourself, how you kind of got into fishing and, that kind of thing.
Sure. So, I think fishing was in my blood like it is for many of us. Right from the very day I was, able to see water, catch fish. Kind of my grandfather and my father were huge pieces of that. My grandfather lived in the Juniata River, pretty much right on the shorelines of just the Raystown branch. So I fished the whole Juniata River in the summertime. We floated it and we would always end up at the mouth of the Juniata, which is down by Duncannon, Pennsylvania. And went to school here in Pennsylvania. When I graduated college, moved to as close as I could get to the river. At that point in time, I was in the Allentown area. So I fished the Delaware a real lot. I was one of the first people in my area to get a jet boat back in the early 90s. There was one or two other guys that had them at the time. And if you can take a look at the river now, at that point in time, there was a lot of guys who were in canoes. The kayak thing really wasn't big yet. Guys were fishing at a smaller car topper boats with a 9.9 tiller prop with a cage on it. So when I had my 90s, actually it was a 60-45 jet on a 16-50 John boat, I was literally one of the first guys that I remember seeing on that. There was a couple guys who owned boat shops in the Delaware. And of course, there was a number of people on the Susquehanna. But I mean, if you saw one at the gas station, you had something to talk about because there just wasn't that many around. And nowadays, on my way to launch every morning, I see two or three jet boats either pass me or I pass them on the way there. So it's amazing how far this has come and how many people now own them. But that's really how I got my start. When I retired, I went to work for about a year and a half at a boat shop. And when that didn't work out, I had done about 7 or 8 years of part-time guiding, and I was part of a TV show called Backwoods Angler TV. And I figured I had a year to figure out what I was doing because of my retirement. I had signed an NDA type deal where I couldn't go back into engineering right away. So I thought, well, I'm going to try this, you know, guiding full time, see if I can handle it, see if I can put it to mustard. And that was 7.5 years ago. And that's pretty much the story.
Still it's interesting. Here. You talk about that. I've seen so many people rig up a pitchfork on their prop to try and guard it from, you know, all the rocks in the river. And, you know, then you hear about jet boats, and I've seen jet boats guys go flying down in what seems like, you know, 6 inches of water. You know, it's just amazing how
if it's set up right, it's scary shallow. I mean, it's shallower than 6 inches and maybe too shallow for some conditions. You know, you could argue both ways, and some are a little bit too fast for the drivers. And I'm sure if you've been in a kayak, you've seen what I mean, right? You can actually, you got to be responsible for not just the people in your boat, but those people around you. And, you know, some of the kayaks are harder to see. Some of these kayaks, they blend in really well. So, you know, I've had to turn around a couple of times and apologize for not seeing somebody fast enough, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's definitely happened to me a few times. Nothing too crazy close, but definitely been waked a few times. So,
yeah.
You definitely got to be careful on those things. I got a buddy, he's kind of new to boating. He went out and bought a brand new jet boat and was running it up the river. And I'm not sure the exact details of it, but ended up slinging him and the guy with him out of the boat.
Yeah, usually the first thing you do on a jet boat is you season the bottom. You know, you put a few dents in it and get it nice and seasoned. And, you know, once those things are kind of done, you kind of takes the edge off of the new boat and makes you run a little bit safer the next time out. But yeah, you can get yourself some trouble. I think a lot of these custom boat guys that show their stuff want to be like, you know, one of these infomercials where the guys are going 900 miles per hour around rocks and slipping around things. And that's really cool until somebody gets hurt thinking that they can do the same thing and not realizing that that guy who's building those boats has hundreds, maybe thousands of hours behind the seat of one of those things. So
it probably knows that river like the back of his hand.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's one of these things where some of these boats are named some funny names to make them seem like they're like indestructible. And the reality is, nothing beats a rock, right? So you can hammer on that rock all day long, but aluminum versus rocks don't work. So
yeah, the rock's going to win pretty much all the time.
It really does. And I think there's a ways of being a little bit more responsible with your adding, but you know, your ads for your boats, but you know, who knows?
Yeah, I guess whatever makes the money is what you're going to go for. So.
Those things are crazy though. I remember when I first started bass fishing, like what, 7, 8 years ago. You know, I was fishing off the bank at the river, and right beside this like really, really shallow area. And here come this boat coming up through there. I'm like, well, he's gonna have to turn around right there, and he came right up through. I'm like, how did he do that? At the time, I didn't know what a jet boat was.
Yeah, we have riffles here that are probably, you know, 3-4 inches, just enough for, you know, if you're in an older style or skinny kayak, that it doesn't displace the water like some of these newer kayaks. And I'll have these people that are, you know, part of a livery service, and they'll be, you know, kayaking for the first time, and they'll come through, get stuck on the shoal. And, you know, the shoals are real wide. They're, you know, several hundred yards wide, and I'll see them stuck on the shoal, and I'll come flying up through there, and I'm a good 200 feet from them, but I'll see them kind of waving me off, you know, don't come through here, it's too shallow. And, you know, I go through there, and then later they go, how did you get through there? Cause they don't see me at the boat ramp or something. And it's like, well, you know, I'm pushing a lot of water with me. So I can go that distance for a little while before I run out of water. But it's kind of interesting to see someone who just goes, you know, is paddling and gets stuck, and then they see you and try to help you out, not realize you can go through that stuff.
Well, something that I do want to say while we're on this subject, of jet boats is if you're kayaking in a river and you're around like real shallow riffles or whatever, and you see a jet boat coming, get out of the way. They can't stop. They got to maintain a certain speed to get up through there in that shallow area. So just move.
Yeah, I think it's a two-way street. I think there's some things, you know, for the jet boat, you have more mobility and more speed. So, I mean, I've sat sometimes and let guys go down through chutes, you know, even if it takes 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes for them to get down through it. If guys are fishing stuff, I'll try to find another way around it. My biggest problem isn't you know, the respect going both ways. It's more how well some of these kayaks blend in. I'm real a big fan of like bright colored greens, you know, yellows, oranges, just love it. You get some of those slate blue ones and those tan ones and of course the camo ones, they're really hard to see. I mean, they look like a rock in the water or a log on a, you really, if the person isn't wearing very colorful clothing, it's difficult to see them in time. So we kind of get seen because you can hear us coming, where you guys are very stealthy. So a lot of times you think we're being jerks, and really what the situation is, we didn't see them. So I try to be as trying to look, you know, everywhere I am, but I'm also looking at the rocks that are in front of me sometimes. So my peripheral is a little bit lacking. So I just think some understanding. I mean, I try to, since I kayak too, I try to have a good view at, you know, both sides of that story. So I don't expect guys to get out of my way. I just don't expect them to sit in the only chute that we have to get through. Right. So sometimes I'll blow my horn or a whistle, and most guys are really good about getting out of the way. And the other thing is, we have to share the river. And because we have the faster, more movable boats, it's best for us sometimes just to wait our turn. That's just my view.
Yeah. And that was good info about the colors to like people that are upgrading boats or maybe looking to get their first boat. You know, that's good info.
If you're not duck hunting, I don't, you know, it's not like you can't. I mean, I've fished, I've done a number of videos, kayak videos with yellow, orange, bright green, you know, boats. And I mean, I've never noticed a fish not biting because my kayak was too colorful. You know, I can see if you're duck hunting, but
I believe that is a fear, but yeah, I've got a decently bright green kayak myself, and I've never had an issue. I don't catch fish anyways, so.
Well, Chris, I was lucky enough to see a recent seminar that you did. I guess was that for the Delaware River Association or something?
It was for the Delaware River Association, and I did it again actually for some local guys here on the Susquehanna.
Yeah, and I caught the end of the first one, and I caught all of the second one. And I was kind of hoping maybe we could cover a little bit of that. You were talking a little bit about kind of the transition into spring, then to summer. And then there was a couple of good tips there. I don't know if you don't mind sharing.
No, sure.
Just talk a little bit about, boat positioning and anything else you want to cover from that seminar.
So just one little thing that I'll just cover as a just a end all. There is no such thing as an end all when it comes to some of these things we're finding out about bass. And if you would have asked me, I've been writing for 27 years for magazines, and I've been guiding for, this is my 15th or 16th year guiding. And I spend a lot of time on the water. I see a lot of things, and I'm telling you that the more time I spend doing this, the more I realize how little I know about it. And what I mean by that is I'm learning something every single day. It's what keeps me happy about doing this job. And being an engineer, I keep a lot of records. I keep a lot of, you know, things that would just drive some people is just nuts, the stuff I keep track of. I mean, but I'm constantly relearning, understanding. And one of the biggest reasons for doing the transitions for bass is how much these bass are moving. I have a friend that we're talking constantly, and it's amazing how much day-to-day moving that you get when you leave winter, where these fish are pretty much stationary all winter long. They do very little moving. And then when that water starts to break into the upper 30s and low 40s here in Pennsylvania, for sure, New York, New Jersey is probably exactly the same way, Delaware, Virginia, West Virginia, because I fish all those places. they start to move. And, you know, if you have a small river, they usually use the banks. They'll travel up the banks, and you can almost look at a map and know what side of the river they're going to be moving up on based on depth and where the current seams are, where the current breaks are. And they'll move. I mean, you know, InFishman did something years and years ago. I'm not sure if I was allowed to mention that, but they did a great report about how far bass in the river travel to spawn. And someone, you know, wrote like 12 miles or 8 miles. And it just seemed ridiculous to me because there's just so many spawning areas. Why would they have to travel that far? But I'll be honest with you. I've seen small creeks where they'll go 4 miles up a small creek in a few days. So if they'll do that in a creek that feeds the river, it's very likely that if they go up to the next creek that's 2 miles away, they just traveled 6 miles without even really trying. So it's amazing how much they move. And I'll be on a pattern where I'll be getting great numbers and great size of fish. And all of a sudden the next day, after, you know, 3 or 4 days of this great pattern, I'll be catching different fish. And I mean different fish, the different class of fish, much smaller fish. And a few days later, it transitions again where I can't find a fish. I've got to go out and start looking for them. But what I've been able to track over the last couple of years is where they are in the river, you know, and how about how fast they move if there isn't a cold front, if there isn't any rises in the water rises in the water levels. But that's one of the tricks for learning how to find these fish. And as the water drops, they'll start to transition away from the shorelines and into these current seams that push them into ledges or into island breaks in the middle of the river, where they'll just, you can actually pretty much follow them day after day after day, moving upriver until they hit their destination. Now, sometimes when I say upriver, they may curl up a creek, and you'll be catching them along this bank that goes to this creek for 5-6 miles. You'll be catching them almost every day, and then all of a sudden they're gone. And they're really not gone. They're just so far up these creeks, you can't get your boat up to it. And they're just up inside these creeks. And that's the fish that you were fishing for. And it's amazing how the big fish move first. I mean, that's the biggest lesson that I'm learning, is that I have to be on the water, you know, early to mid March, because I want those biggest fish first. And if you've been following my reports, you'll see some of the monster fish we're catching, because you're out there when these first fish are leaving. So based on metabolism, based on how much they have to eat to keep this body mass, based on procreation, the bigger fish generally have more eggs. They have to move first. They're the first ones to go. So it's like an early pregnancy, right? You know, if it's your first child, you generally have a bunch of false pregnancies. So these people who have 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 children, you know, their deliveries go really quick. I think that's a lot of the way it is with some of these bass. They realize they have to get to where they're going. They start earlier and they arrive sooner. And therefore, if you're following them, you get a chance to catch them all the way up until they're about ready to spawn. So that's why transition was so important for me to cover.
I had read something interesting about that too, that bass will often return to the place where they were spawned, you know, right. and there's something about it, that area, that they know, and they will return even if they move far, far away from it.
Right. Similar to salmon. Of course, they don't have anywhere near the scent tracking that salmon does, but a salmon will travel, you know, hundreds of miles if they need to spawn. Where bass, we're talking, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 miles max usually. But they will go back to the grounds that they were, you know, probably they were born in. It's their home grounds, unless there's some kind of catastrophe, you know, a major flood, or it's silted over so much that there isn't, you know, good habitat anymore, or the food base is gone and it can't keep them there long enough to do their procreation. So as long as you have the food base, as long as there's still the protected waters that were already there. We had 2 or 3 floods in 2010 to 2014 that were devastating floods, 2 50-year floods and 100-year flood. And it changed places, especially on the Delaware. And I've seen it here on the Susquehanna as well, where you knew fish were going to be there, but now they're less of a place that you can go to. Other places are still there and still holding strong, but they're not what they once were. So that's why I say, usually if they're born there and they last 10 years, they're going to be, you know, they're going to be there every year for, you know, while they're alive.
That's crazy. It, you know, it just made me think, like, you know, say us, like, I'm sure pretty much everybody, their childhood home, you know, has got a little special place to them. You know, it's I kind of associate that with what you're talking about. Like, it's like their childhood home.
Yeah. And then how to get there, no matter where they are, no matter how bad the floods have been previous years, no matter how far downriver they get washed. I mean, I'm sure there's a destination that they'll change if they have to, but I think most of them return to the same place. If we had a way of tagging it, I think it would be very interesting, but you know, that would be way too much money than any state could afford to do. So, you know, I usually start out with, you know, I'm looking for that trend and that warming trend. You know, I'm looking at trees, and, you know, of course trees bud in the fall, but they bloom in the spring. So I'm looking to see any kind of growth, you know, those first little bit of flowers that come up, that the trees that start to show their very first, you know, blooms. I'm always looking for something to show me that I'm watching other nature. I'm watching, you know, ducks and geese and the way that they're reacting, that they're gathering and they're nesting, because it all kind of happens, you know, at the same time. And as you keep notes, you start to make a note of it, right? I mean, and you don't, you have longer daylights, you know, so there's not just temperature, it's also the daylight that gets them going. But I start to target my bass knowing that they have to feed. I usually start to get more aggressive with my lure presentations. So I will tell you this, that no matter when you fish, and I fish year round every single month, at least once every 2 weeks in the wintertime, until the river freezes. And if it doesn't freeze, I'm going as often as I can. And I'm not afraid of getting skunked, so I'm out there a lot. But soft plastics are something you always have to have on your boat. There's not a time when you want to just leave that stuff at home. So, you know, a tube, some kind of Z-Man type Ned rig, any kind of jig and pig, just something that you're comfortable with, whether it's a bug style bait or, you know, a creature or a worm minnow, you know, swim bait type deal. You always want to have that stuff in your boat. But as these fish start to get more and more active, I think the very first hard bait I get out is a jerk bait. Now, I'll have my jerk baits all winter long, but I fish them quite a bit differently in the springtime. And I also will throw a much larger profile in the spring because I know they're coming out of, you know, not hibernation, but they're very dormant. And they eat in the wintertime, but not every day. So you can go out fishing and you can be sitting on top of the fish and they're just not eating because, you know, a certain percentage of them just don't eat every single day that time of year. So I'll start to throw the 110, the 115, the 100 size jerk baits, and I'll change my cadence up from being very slow in the wintertime to being very, very aggressive, to where the pause is less than 2 seconds. You know, that's kind of where the pause is. And then I'll transition from there to fishing more aggressive tubes, more aggressive swim bait. I'll throw a lot of crankbaits. I love square wheel crankbaits. And so when that water's up in the 47, 48, 49 degree mark, that's when I'm getting that stuff out. I love a spinnerbait bite, but I'll wait until the 49, 50, 51, 52 degrees for that spinnerbait bite to kick. And I know I'm missing a few fish there, but I want them to be on it. I don't want to have to force feed them anything. So I start my trips off. I have some kind of a jig, you know, whether it's a Ned rig or a hula stick or a Z-Man Bugsy or a tube. I love the 2.75 to 3.5 inch single dip tubes. I love swim baits. I don't care who makes them. You know, Kitech makes a great one. Fit makes a great one. There's just a number of companies out there that make good swim baits, but that's always on like a group of rods in the boat. And then I'll have a couple rods rigged with a jerk bait and a couple rods rigged with a crank bait. Now, just today or yesterday, I started throwing more spinner baits, and we're getting a couple, but it's not like they're the answer yet. But probably within a week or two, when that water is at 50 and steady at 50, that's going to have to be something that you have to have with you at all the time. So again, it's following where these fish are and looking at, you know, if you've got a cold front, you've got to be looking for softer bottom, you know, because they're not really in the rocks quite yet. And after getting ready to spawn, they're going to be out and the current seems more. So we had talked about boat position a little bit in our seminar. And it's very important for kayaks too. A lot of us come out of the winter into the spring thinking that the bass are all in this dead water. And it's not that you won't catch a few fish in that dead water, that real calm water. But if you don't have high water, you should really be looking at current. So if your river, normal flow for your river, and you can look this up on most of your charts, most of your real-time charts that, you know, that the USGS has, if your regular depth, your median depth is, let's say, 5 feet, and you're at 7, then yes, you know, look for that slack water, look for the tight to bank, tight to cover, tight to an island, tight to an eddy type spot. But if it's normal, like today, we were finding most of our fish not tight to the bank, but literally off and out in the current seam. So I wish I had the picture to show you, but you know, if you normally fish with your kayak, where you're sitting inside the seam or sitting at the seam throwing into the shoreline, you might be sitting on top of the fish. So two suggestions is either to move further out to the current, which is harder boat control, and throw to, you know, throw into the shallow water, but make sure that you're working it back into that current seam, or put the boat, fish at that foot, fish the slow water first, then put the boat in the eddy and find a way to either anchor or clip yourself off and throw out to the current seam and bring it back into that slow water, because they're very current related. And if you look at minnows are also very often right at the current edge. You know that the crayfish like the current. They pick up a lot of debris and a lot of stuff, but they're eating off the current. So, I mean, it doesn't have to be rock and hard current, but one of the biggest lessons that I hear almost every spring is, I wouldn't have fished here because of how fast the current is. And that's usually after about 5 or 6 fish being caught in, you know, 1 to 3 mile per hour current, which is a pretty swift current. And they'll go to me, well, I really wasn't expecting to catch fish. I wouldn't have gone to this spot. I would have spent my time, you know, on the bank somewhere or off an eddy. And while we do catch a few fish there, I think that how much bass relate to current in a river is probably one of the most misunderstood pieces to river fishing.
A couple of questions from that. You mentioned working a jig aggressively, or a tube aggressively. I always heard a tube is kind of a, you know, you let it cast it out and let it fall, and it does like a swirly thing, and that's the main draw of that. But
yeah, I mean, when I fish a tube, I fish it as light as I possibly can. So if I can fish it on a 16th or an 8th, that's my choice. If I can't, I try to go to 3/16ths, and I rarely ever go as high as a quarter, because I want to drag it, right? So to find out what mood these bass are in, I'll let it sit and then I'll drag it. I'll let it sit and I'll drag it a little bit. So that's how my winter fishing usually goes. But once they start to get aggressive, you'll notice it's almost like a cat and mouse game. So if you've ever played with a cat, and if the ball's just sitting there and never moves, they don't even bother with it, right? There's a string or a ball or a light. But the more you move that light, the more they're interested in getting it. And I don't know if they want to kill it or eat it, but what I'll do is I'll throw the tube out, and I usually throw the tube out perpendicular. So I'm not throwing it upriver. I'm throwing it straight across, and I'm balancing it down the current line into, you know, from usually slack water into the fast water. And by being aggressive, what I'm talking about is that quick lift, that lift, right? So in the wintertime, I'm barely moving the so it's not aggressive at all. But I'm not opposed to taking throwing it out and doing, you know, a crawfish hop, or, you know, just popping it, letting it come up, right? And then same thing with when I say tube, you could do this with a grub, you could do it with a Ned rig. I'll pop it and let it fall to the bottom. Then I'll pop it again. And it's like a crankbait bite or a jerkbait bite, where sometimes it isn't even the profile of the bait, it's the action of the bait that's getting them to go off on it. So that's what I mean by aggressive. We're talking about a swim bait. I'll sometimes let my swim bait go out and fall, and then I'll bring it back, and then I'll let it go back out, and I'll reel it and bring it back. What I'll do a lot of times is, you know, it could be a steady retrieve. Right now, what I'm doing is I'll throw it out there, I'll let it hit the bottom, and I'll jerk it, reel a couple times, let it hit bottom, jerk it, almost like it's either a crayfish, even though it's a minnow shape, either it's like a crayfish that's doing it, or one of those dace or darters that hop from rock to rock, and that gets their attention. And once they see it, they're locked onto it, and they can barely get themselves to not hit it. So it's a reaction strike, right? I think in the seminar I talked about a bee, right? So, you know, you're not swatting at the bee as a human being to try to get that bee, not trying to catch it, right? You're just trying to knock it out of the way. And sometimes I think the bass aren't trying to eat it. They're just trying to knock it out of the way. And sometimes that can be as good as their hunger could be secondary to their reaction, right? So it's one of those things where, is it a reaction strike or is it a hunger strike? So it's I like the reaction strike, because if I can get them to go on it, I don't have to wait for them for the dinner bell, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Totally.
You know, there's actually one more type of bite that we learned about recently with one of our other co-hosts, Dan Perry. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it's called the Dorito bite.
The Dorito bite? No, I haven't heard that one.
That's what he calls it for the Ned rig. Because he said Ned rig, you know, even if you're full, already ate, he said, if somebody offers you a Dorito, you're going to eat the Dorito.
You're going to eat it.
Yeah, I mean, you got to eat the Dorito.
Yeah, I mean, river fish in general are opportunistic, right? Because they don't have the luxury of following pods of bait fish around like they do in a river. So what I always tell people is they're opportunistic. If you can just get it inside in front of their face, they're generally going to eat it. And so sometimes the wonderful thing about their Ned rig is it's a small little snack. You know, it's what, 2.5-3 inches long. It's a small little snack. And I've caught, you know, we've caught 42, 43 inch muskie on a stupid Ned rig fishing for bass because it's a snack. It's going to land in front of my face. I'm just going to eat it because it's a snack.
Yeah, that's basically what.
So I like the Dorito
bite. Yeah,
I may have to use it. Does he have that set up where that's you know, is that, does he have that
trademarked or anything?
Is it trademarked? It's not trademarked. No.
It will be by the time this airs.
It better be, because I think we might be using that one.
Another thing you mentioned, and I would think it would be applicable to kayaks as well, is when you're casting like your jerk baits and stuff, you're casting them out like you said perpendicular and letting them go down with the current, kind of almost behind the boat, versus casting upstream because it's always going to get snagged. And that was one thing that I always did, and what I can't wait to get out and try that now, because I always thought I wanted to be hitting them in the face.
That's funny. See, I think if you're a lake fisherman by heart and you watch a lot of these, you know, programs on TV, they want you throwing the jerkbait on a slack line, and I think that's 100%. Right, correct, right? And it's not that you can't do that on the river, but it's less effective because you've always got the current pulling the bait anyway. So it's not like wind on a lake, because it's not always windy. And there is a little bit of a current in a lake, but on a river, it's a very consistent current. So I had a young man who was actually watching the seminar. He watched it twice. And today he got to prove to himself that, you know, this technique that I was sharing really paid dividends, and it did pay dividends for him today because it cut out a lot of wasted time and wasted motion. So I generally like to have the boat fairly slow, almost stopped in the current if I can. So I'm not saying you can't throw it while you're drifting. Of course you can. But I envision fish looking at a jerk bait just kind of sitting there, you know, waiting for it to do something, or they come up to it. If you've ever watched sailfish to come up to a bait, they actually like almost like swim at a certain 6-7 miles per hour, but it almost is like effortless force, and they're just looking at it and they back off and they come up and they back off, and then all of a sudden they hit it. I always, when I'm throwing a jerkbait, envision the fish looking at my jerkbait the whole time. It keeps me engaged in what I'm doing. So I like to have my boat pointed upriver, either anchored or with a trolling motor going, or, you know, if I'm paddling, I usually have a paddle in my hand. I'm kind of trying to keep myself from going slower than the current is going. And I throw that bait out quartered downriver, not straight downriver, not straight out, but quartered downriver, almost at a 45 degree angle, if you will. And I'll give it two pops to get it down to where it's, you know, it's supposed to be at its running thing. And I'll give it, you know, let it float. And I'll pop it again twice. But the whole time I'm doing this, the bait really is never on a slack line, except for when I go to pop it. And on a lake, you don't want that. On a lake, you want the bait to quiver and do everything it's supposed to do on that slack line. But if you do that on a lake, on a river, you know, a number of things can happen. You could be, because it's drifting, you could be getting caught in debris. You could be, you know, literally missing where the fish are. And what we've learned, and I think a lot of river anglers, you know, do this almost without even thinking about it, is by throwing it quarter down and letting it do that swing, right, where it swings behind the boat, they're noticing that, gee, my strikes are coming almost at the very bottom of my swing. So why waste all that time throwing it way up here and letting the bait come slowly down through here? It might take, you know, 40, 50, 60 seconds or longer to get down to where it is, where if you get that strike and you know where it is, you can kind of pinpoint it instead of throwing it out 45, maybe you're throwing it out even, you know, 65 degrees, if you know what I mean, rather than just straight out the back. So that's kind of, you know, the big difference between how I throw a jerkbait in a lake and how I throw it in a river. Now, don't get me wrong. If I'm throwing into an eddy somewhere, I'm going to throw it on slack line, right? But if I've got current, and I mean rocking current. Today I was in, the boat was literally, you know, at the edge of the current and I was throwing into waves, you know, and that jerk bait was, you know, coming out. And as soon as it broke the waves into the softer seam, you know, we were getting clobbered. So it's not that you can't throw on a slack line or not that you shouldn't, but in a river condition, especially this time of year, spring and fall, you don't have to, you can kind of let it go down into the current seam. And, you know, that's kind of where you're going to get most of your strikes. And again, if it's working for you, don't stop it. So what I tell people is, if you're getting your bites more out to the side, keep on throwing out to the side. But if you find that 90% of your bites are at the bottom of your swing, just cut out that middle ground and throw 45 or less so that you can get down to that swing just in less time. So that's the point I was trying to make.
You know, you said you kayak as well. Do you... what's your technique for using a jerk bait in a kayak? You know, I've got buddies that do it and stuff, but man, I don't know if you're standing, yeah, you can do it, but man, sitting down and trying to do that jerk motion, I have so much trouble with that.
It is. And so I'll try to get myself into a situation where I can put my leg out on a, you know, on a rock, or I'll pin myself. I have these little, you know, anchor pins that I'll pin myself into like more of a slack area and throw it out into the current so I can still jerk it. What's difficult is, you know, you the cast is not a problem. It's getting that rod tip low in a kayak and not hit, you know, because I like my, in a boat it's really easy because, you know, you've got all that room to force the boat down. And I'll see guys, you know, trying to jerk the bait sideways, but it really has to be jerk down to get that bait where it's supposed to go. If your rod tip is up or neutral, it's not going to dive to the depth that it's supposed to. So one trick might be to use like a deep diving lip versus a standard, even though you're in only 4 foot of water, because by where your rod tip is, it's going to keep that thing from going super deep. And yet will dive to the area that you want it to. I think a lot of people don't realize that when the direction that they're jerking that in is driving that bait up, not down to dig like it should be. So that's, you know, rod tip down and you're jerking it is really difficult in a kayak. So I don't want to be focusing on keeping my boat still or not moving. Mm-hmm. So I'll kind of, you know, either get myself in an eddy where I'm moving slower than the current is, or I'll pin myself, or I talked about this in the seminar about anchoring off with a grabber or something like that, so I can kind of concentrate on that area, because you may have a group of fish at the front of a ledge, you know, where that water's cascading over a ledge, but they're right in front of it or right behind it. And if you can keep on hitting the same spot over and over again, which is kind of easy in a boat, if you can duplicate that in a kayak, I think you'll have more success with that kind of a bait, you know, versus a crankbait where you can be moving with a crankbait and throwing to 10 or 15 different targets, you know, constantly just moving all around. And, you know, it's, even if you don't catch the fish, if you get that bite, that short bite, or you get that follow, you know, you've got the attention, you know where that fish came from, and you can go back there and throw a more finesse style bait to catch that fish, because you know he's there already, because he's kind of, you know, identified himself by either smacking the bait and not getting caught, or following it in and cutting off short, you know. So even just seeing the fish gives you confidence to know, okay, that fish came out of that, you know, behind that rock or in that eddy or in that current seam. So I know they're there. So now I can, you know, focus it and fish it more, you know, more determined with a soft plastic or a swim bait or something that I can have more control over.
I might have to try that the deeper diving jerk bait.
It may, you know, that plus
stuck in my head right there.
You know, just because if your rod tip is up, that bait's going to sit higher in the column than it's supposed to. It's like running a crankbait, right? The crankbait, if you've got your rod tip deep and you're spinning it, it's going to go as deep as it possibly can. If you level it out, it's going to run a little bit less shallow, a little bit less deep. And if you hold your rod tip up, that thing's not going to run as deep, you know, by a long shot. So it's spinnerbait's the same way. I mean, if you hold the rod tip up, which is a little bit more work, if you hold it up, it'll kind of wake just under the surface without having to move it really fast. You just hold it up and it'll kind of, you know, be forced to sit in that upper plane. And a lot of times that's the difference between the same guy throwing the same spinnerbait and not is, you know, if they're on the bottom and you're slow rolling it, that's great. But if they're on that, if they're looking for that bait just under the surface, subsurface, and you're not holding your rod tip the way it's supposed to, you're just going to make, you know, one guy's catching and you're not, you're wondering why, and it's all rod position. You know, key with spinnerbaits, crankbaits, jerkbaits.
Interesting. And like he said, on a kayak, sometimes you're limited to your rod position, but it, sometimes it pays to experiment a little bit. And
yeah, you overcome it. I mean, it's what I find is that people who wade and people who are kayak fishing, because they can get over the obstacles and because they have smaller areas to fish, you know, they don't have, like today I went 12 miles in a jet boat, right? Who does that in a kayak? You know, you just really do it upstream. You tend to be a better, more efficient angler because you're fishing in a smaller body of water, a smaller targeted area. And so you're picking that area apart versus running and gunning and running over top of fish to catch fish. So I think sometimes when I had my smaller, slower boats, I was a better angler at times. I was more patient, let's put it that way, right? So, and sometimes, you know, today's catching was slow in the morning and good in the afternoon. And if I couldn't talk myself into rushing, you know, I needed to slow down, knowing that the day would evolve. It always evolves, you know. And we got our fish. It just took us, you know, towards the second half of the day because the first half was slow. And you'll have those days. And the key is to try not let that get too much into your head. You know, you're going to catch them. Just don't get too far out of your game plan. Pay attention to what's going on. If something works, then just repeat. If you get a bite or a strike, I always tell people, where'd you throw it? Because you want to throw it back to that same spot again, because bass are rarely ever alone. You know, in the summertime, even in the summertime when they have smaller hunting groups, there's usually two or three bass that are out cruising with each other in these pockets, right? So if you throw and you get one to strike, believe me, that bass that was trailing with him, he saw him eat something and now he's interested in eating it as well. If you've ever been on a frenzy, you see where bass try to knock the bait out of another bass's mouth. And that happens quite a bit. As a matter of fact, it happens as soon as like right now. You know, we start getting these frenzies going. If you can get one to eat, you can usually get two.
I don't know if I speak for Ryan, but I sometimes, you know, I'm still new enough to this game that I get so excited that I catch one that I completely forget about throwing back into that exact same spot.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important. I mean, I triangulate, and I'll say, listen, here's the most important part is if you know how far off the bank that strike came, if you know where you put that. I mean, I watch bubble lines in the water. When I'm fishing, sometimes if the wind is blowing a different way, it's difficult to know where that eddy is or where that seam is. But there's always a bubble line, you know, something, a bubble that's moving slower than the outside bubbles or the inside bubbles. I'm always looking to see where we threw it. And I'll tell clients, you didn't throw it there. You threw it over there. Throw it back over there again. And generally, the next time they throw back in that exact same spot, they crush it. I mean, and that's really the difference between some of your anglers who are more consistent is that they pay attention to just the small things. It's not really a technique deal. It's really paying attention to, okay, well, I threw the bait in here. I got hit here. I'm going to do that until the fish stop biting. Or I had the fish here yesterday. If they're still here, are they further down in the current seam? Are they further down in the hole? Are they further up? And that's just making just small little adjustments to your game every day, you know, to catch the fish.
That's pretty cool. I like that. It makes it tough sometimes, you know, when you see it day in and day out and you can kind of track the fish movement a little bit better. Where versus
weekend warriors
who kind of are at the mercy of kind of
I wouldn't use that term as a derogative term. It's, you know, I feel bad for some of those guys that have to, they caught them last Sunday and now Saturday's here again and they don't know, you know, where to begin. And you know, sometimes it can be a good thing going out there fresh, but a lot of times it's so much easier to know, okay, I did this yesterday, I did this the day before, and I know it works. I just got to figure out where, you know, what's the difference between today and yesterday.
Yeah, you can just kind of follow them.
Yeah, and you can kind of have confidence, you know, it's going to work. Like yesterday was slow, so I wasn't surprised when today was slow to start. And so I could, you know, I talked to my clients, say, listen, we're going to get them. They're just a little bit finicky right now. We just got to be patient, and it will come. And it did. So it's one of those things where, you know, even getting out of my own head going, you know, you see a guy catch a fish or two guys catch a fish, and you know that, you know, your turn's coming. You just got to kind of wait it out. And it's just a matter of time before it happens. And then, you know, every day we put together a pattern. Every day I'm trying to learn something. And usually there's something. I mean, today's lesson was just perseverance. You knew that they were going to hit. And if you ran around too much, you know, you tried a few different things and one thing worked and you tried it again to see if that same type thing worked. And usually you build a pattern. And that's the way today went for me personally.
No. Do you use any type of electronics on the river, or do you just go?
I do, but I don't. I mean, it's not like a lake. I mean, if I was a lake fisherman, I would probably have, you know, I would be like a lot of these guys who have $2,000, $3,000 into their sonars. For me in the river, the sonar does, you know, basically a few things for me. I'll say three. Tells me the water temperature, which I think is important. Some guys don't care, but I really like to know the water temperature because I want to know where it is relative to the morning and the afternoon, where it was relative to the day before, are we trending up? Are we trending down? Is there an influence? Like if I buy a creek where now I've got 3 or 4 degrees warmer, you know, a lot of these bigger rivers, like for us, we have the Juniata River, you know, that water coming out of the Juniata might be 2 or 3 degrees warmer. And so that whole bank, once you get out to the main river, you know, for a mile or two is going to be warmer. So it's not, while that might not be a good thing in the summertime, it's a real good thing in the springtime when fish are looking for warmer habitat. It just not even the fish, but also the prey, right? They're going to be more active. They're all cold-blooded creatures. So the warmer that water is, the more active they are. The more active they are, the more prone they are to eat. So, and they have to because their metabolism is up. The second thing that I do is I want to know the depth because I can't always see what the depth is, right? So if I notice, hey, I'm catching fish in 5 foot of water, I want to know when I'm, you know, in about 4.5 to 5 foot of water. So that's important to me. Yeah, you could use your fishing rods, but my fishing rods are like $250 a piece. I don't want to be using them to test, you know, how deep the rocks are. So, I mean, yes, there is a way to do that. You know, I've had friends that do that. My rods are a little bit more, I mean, I don't want to do that to my rods. And then the other thing that I do is because I fish so many rivers and I fish so many miles of rivers, I don't have a home boat ramp. Like I know a lot of guys who guide launch out of the same boat ramp every single day, and power to them. I bore very easily. So I need variety. So I'll launch in 1 week. I'll launch out of 3 or 4 different boat launches in 5 days. Throughout the year, I'm on 5 different rivers and probably 60 different boat ramps, right? So because of that, I don't memorize where every rock is, every ledge is, every location. So I do use waypoints like you would on a lake, and I use them. I have them, you know, I have them right now on mine for Virginia, for West Virginia, for Maryland, for New Jersey, for New York, for Pennsylvania. So I mean, I just don't know that you can. I can't memorize every spot, and so that's why I keep a logbook. It's why I have this stuff on my sonar, but those are the three things for sonars for me. If I was fishing a lake, I would love to have some kind of side imaging or live imaging or something that you could actually look at and go, okay, well, that's definitely a fish. And I'm looking under that dock or under that, you know, that bank abutment over there so that, you know, in the wintertime, you're not fishing over zero fish. But in a river, I'm pretty confident I know where the winter holes are, and I'll work it out, but without having to spend $2,500 on a live scope or something like that.
Yeah.
That was going to be one of my questions too, because I think in the first seminar I called, I heard the back end of one of those questions. And you said you, when you're searching for fish, you look more at the surface of the water than you would at a fish finder. And I was going to ask you what you look for then.
So it's amazing. If you've ever been out in a wind storm or in a light rainstorm, when the wind hits the surface of the water, or when the rain hits the surface of water, it pretty much shows where the ledges are. And if you've ever seen that or not, it kind of shows you where ledges are that are, you know, that the current's not flowing over and showing you where those ledges are. The other thing is you can watch where the bubble line of the current is. Sometimes you can't see the current because there's no visible thing going around the rock, but you can watch the bubble lines do these weird things where they move, or one set of bubble line will be moving this fast and the other one's moving really slow. So you kind of know that there's a flow difference there between, you know, inside the rocks. The other thing I look for is where they come together, because sometimes we have these ledges that will protrude out of the water. And then there'll be a break in the ledge, and there'll be two pieces of water that come down into that. And where those two currents meet again creates a secondary eddy. So just being able to read the bubble lines, being able to read the water. I mean, it's easy easier in the fall when you see leaves floating, you can kind of get an idea of where they are. It's a little harder to fish through. But I think learning the bubble lines and learning to read the water, you know, is a key factor. I mean, sometimes our boat's positioned on top of the fish and it really needs to be off. And you, if you could see the bubble line before you feel it, like if you've ever eddied out in a kayak, now that's an extreme thing, but if you've ever gotten yourself into a kayak, you might feel where it's, oh, wow, it's easy to paddle here, or I don't have to really do much. I'm just sitting in this pond. You might be sitting on the fish because you got sucked into that. Well, it's no different with a bigger boat. It takes a while to get to learn that, right? But if you can see that before you feel it, now you haven't disrupted the fish. Doesn't mean you can't back out of it and give it a few minutes to refreshen up. But, you know, that's the other thing. Another thing that's different than a lot of bodies of water is that in river, especially this time of year, you could fish a spot in the morning and catch one fish or none. But if you revisit that spot a couple hours later, it's probably not the same group of fish, especially now if they're all moving, right? If they're, you know, I'm not talking about spawning fish or winter fish or fish that are at summertime and it's July, late July, they've been in this pattern. The river hasn't changed. We haven't got a lot of water. We haven't got a lot of, you know, it's been hot. If they're in those spots, they're not going to really move too much of the spots. They're going to move in and up and out of the eddies, in and out of the current seams in the riffles, but they're not making these big moves. Right now they're moving. So you fish that rock that you fished two or three days ago or a year ago, and you know you caught fish there. Don't give up on it if you don't catch them there. Just go back a couple hours later. You might be surprised to find that there's a brand new group of fish in that area. So, I mean, it's a time of year when you can refish an area and not really beat it up because the fish are constantly moving. A new group of fish are moving in. And I'm talking more, you know, I'm not talking about a specific winter hole where, you know, those 72 bass are there all winter and that's what they're going to be there. And if you go there enough, you'll start to catch the one with a bad eye and you'll catch the one that's got the nose, you know, it's got a shortened nose or something. That's a different story than what I'm talking about when you're talking about the transitions in the spring. There's just so much movement.
You say that transitions to lakes as well, or are you talking just rivers?
Sure, in a lake. So if you're largemouth fishing, and I grew up largemouth fishing also, you know, a lot of farm ponds where I grew up. If I had a bass behind a stump, there was a bass behind that stump almost every time I went there. And if it didn't eat, I'd go over to the stump and spook him, right, just to prove that he was there. Smallmouth are not really like that. They still like, you know, they're still like a good home, a good position, but smallmouth move a lot, right? They're going to follow bait. Well, the same story on a lake, right? So, you know, the hardest time to find fish at a lake is usually in the summer when they're chasing these pods of bait fish. So your best anglers generally find that pod of bait fish. Then they find the bass and they fish the bass and catch them until that pod disperses. Then they go find another pod of bait fish. On the river, it's not quite like that. They have neighborhoods where they can actually feed on crayfish or feed on a group of minnows that are more, they're not minnows that are in group or pods. Now, this is different on the on the Delaware and the lower Susquehanna where they have shad fry, and those shad fry are balled up in the fall time or late summer, and they're following those shad fry. That's a different story. I'm talking about your dace, your darters, your stone cats that are pretty much, they're in their residence and the bass are just there picking them apart, right? They live there. They don't wander too far from those areas. If they were, they're born in this grass bed, they're probably going to stay in that grass bed until, you know, till the end of the summer or early fall. And then they'll migrate to wintering areas like everything else does. But they just don't, I don't think that they chase bait miles on a river. I think pretty much, unless it's a frog, a frog migration or an eel migration or a shad migration, or, you know, occasionally, I think on the Susquehanna, we have emerald shiners that gather and spawn. If it isn't one of those events, I don't think the bass are traveling to eat. I think they're eating locally.
Cool. Well, I mean, that covers a bunch of what you went over in the seminar. And I figured real quick, I'd ask you, just pick your brain real quick. As a guide, I'm sure you see all spectrum of fishermen, and from noobs up to, you know, people who really know what they're doing. And I was wondering, like, what the top three mistakes you see from kind of younger or amateur or rookie fishermen, noobs, if you will.
Sure. I mean, I not really mistakes, or just things that they could actually consider. So I'll tell you one thing. I've learned a lot of things by not dismissing somebody or doing something different than I do, right? So sometimes if someone says to me, I'm going to try this, I don't talk them out of it right away, because it may work. And then after a while, if it's not working, I'll kind of coach them to try something different. And if it is working, I usually give them credit for it. You know, hey, I wouldn't have done that, and I'm really glad I didn't tell you not to do it, because it worked out. One of the things that I think that there are certain rods that are better than others for doing certain applications. So having an extra fast, super fast rod tip and trying to throw a crankbait might not work for me personally. I think you need a softer, slower rod for crankbaits. So I'll give a person a crankbait because I think it's a very powerful tool, or a lipless crankbait like a rattle trap. And they'll go, oh, I don't like to throw them because I always lose fish on them. And if you look at their rod, you know why, because the rod is just so quick and so responsive that the bass has it all over them when it comes time to jump or spit or maneuver. So if they would just go to a slower action rod, which would be terrible for, throwing a tube or a swim bait, they would up their game a little bit. So I think that, teaching people that there is an advantage to the rod type and the type of line is one of the first things that they get in the boat and they realize with me, is that I have crankbait rods, I have a jerkbait rod, I have rods I use for my jigging, and I even use different lines for that stuff so that they can feel it better. And it's not that I'm saying, you can't use one rod, but I think that if you're learning and you get, it's like having a framing hammer, but trying to do finish work. I mean, you could do it, but it's not the best tool to use for doing it. So it's not that you can't do it, but why wouldn't you give yourself, especially being new, give yourself the best opportunity? So, I mean, I literally explain why I'm using the braid that I'm using and when I use it, and why I don't use braid for crankbaits, for jerkbaits, why I don't use it for spinnerbaits. But I really like it when I'm doing jig work, because it's instant. I feel that thump. I feel it instantly. I can set the hook with a little bit less power and still drive the hook. That's something I don't want to do with a crankbait. I don't want to drive that hook because the fish is already setting himself up with the hook. I want a little bit slower hook set, and it'll still drive it. And yet, because that rod responds slower, that fish has much less chance of jumping and throwing that bait. So that's the one key, is just the equipment piece of it. The other thing is not understanding when to throw what types of baits. Not that it doesn't matter. Not that it matters, not to try different things once in a while, but there are certain seasonal things. And a lot of guys don't have success with things because they throw it. Let's say I threw a spinnerbait last week. It didn't work. Well, tell me the conditions. Well, nothing was working. Well, why would you expect a spinnerbait to work? Right. So when you want it, if you want to learn a bait, try to understand when it works best. And when you're catching them on your favorite thing, put that favorite thing down and start to use this other thing so you can build the techniques. Don't be afraid to watch podcasts like this or look online and try to find out things, or just get advice from clubs. What's that?
I said, it's so hard to do, though.
It is so hard to do, but if you really want to get better at it.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where if you really want to get better at it. Yeah, it's, I know guys that will go, okay, I'm taking nothing out but this. And I'm not saying to do that. But if you're catching fish on your favorite lure, put it down and start to throw the other things to see if they'll hit that, and you'll grow confidence in it. I mean, I'll have guys fish a crankbait with me and go home and spend $50 on crankbaits, right? I mean, it happens. They'll never throw fish on a swim bait. They'll come out with me. We'll catch a whole bunch of fish with swim baits, and they'll order 100 swim baits that night. So it's just, it can be, you know, tough on your wallet, but it's one of those things where once you see, the other thing is to fish with as many different people as you possibly can. So by fishing with a bunch of different people, and I mean fishing with them, either on the same boat or, you know, have your kayaks close by the entire time, watch what they're doing, and you'll pick up a lot of traits that you wouldn't get. So if you're always fishing with the same person, you're going to be limited to what both of you know, where if you fish with a bunch of different people, you know, that's why some of these invitationals or some of these contests or rodeos or whatever you want to call the gatherings where guys are getting together in club events, you know, you learn a lot because you're watching somebody else fish. They might fish differently than you do. Right. And sometimes it can be, you know, really tough because you're a fast fisherman and that person is painfully slow finesse fisherman and just doesn't mix. So of course that's one of the things. So equipment and then learning new stuff. Those are the two things that I see most people do. And the other thing is being too confident in what you don't know. And I think as guides, we're constantly doing that. And so this is not just a newbie thing. It's, well, I saw, you know, Kevin Van Dam, who I really like, by the way, he said, don't do this on this type of a day. Well, I can tell you what, I've caught more fish on top water on sunny days than I have in cloudy days. So just because the conditions aren't perfect for it doesn't mean those fish aren't already looking up and just destroying baits on a sunny afternoon, right? Bluebird sky day, just destroying top water. So sometimes you got to think out of the box and try something because you can think all, you know, all the bass tricks or all the fishing tricks are, but ultimately it's the bass who's eating and they're going to tell you what they want. So, you know, you've got to be willing to be flexible. If they want top water, throw top water. If they don't want top water, you can throw top water to your blue in the face. If they're looking down and they're bottom oriented, you're not going to catch fish that day. You might catch one or two, but is that really what you're looking for when you go out on your Friday, Saturday, Sunday afternoons?
I think that's definitely some good info, man. So, Ryan, you have any other questions? I know I have a ton of things I could ask, and I think, you know, man, we'll definitely have to have you back on again because I
have a
ton of questions I have. Fishing current, it's still something I've learned. I don't feel like I always have the best feel for my lures when they're in the current, like especially, you know, you're saying throw light, like, you know, 1/8 ounce. Quarter ounce.
Yeah, I mean, since we live so close, if we could get together one of these evenings, or, you know, even this year in the evenings, because I'm usually free in the evenings, I could show you some things that might reshape the way that you look at certain baits and the way we use them in current, and letting the current do a lot more work than what we're doing. And from a kayak standpoint, since you're doing so much with boat control and everything else around you, having a technique that works where you're not, you know, having to be super critical on how that's working and still catching fish could be a plus. So we might want to try to get together later this spring or early this summer.
That would be awesome. And I'm definitely going to talk to my father-in-law too and look at your dates for 2022, because I think that would be a blast as well.
Super. So. Super.
Man, these episodes with these big time river guys are interesting. Like, especially for me, like I'm still kind of newer to river fishing. You know, I'm loving it, but I still got a lot to learn about it.
So, yeah, and I'm telling you, I have this is not to brag, but I've probably written 120 articles on river fishing that have been published, and I have. We did a TV show for 3 years, and I've been guiding for 16 years. It all means nothing because I'm still learning every single day I go out, and I'm still getting schooled. I mean, it's what makes chasing these smallmouth or whatever bait, whatever fish you trace, that so much fun, because, you know, all the books, all the stuff that you read, all the things you have in your head that you know to be, or at the time to be 100% factual, you know, that can be just completely disrupted in one event as you're out there going, I know it's not supposed to work, but today we caught about crankbaits, and, you know, or we were throwing top water and it was a bluebird sky, and, you know, there was no hatch, there was no other action. We just accidentally threw something on the surface and boom, it hit it as soon as they hit it. And so we started playing around with it. So I just think it's important that, you know, there are some really key factors to, that you can almost always count on being very true. And there's other ones that will constantly be disproved because fish are fish. They're going to eat what they want to eat, when they want to eat it, how they want to eat it.
Another thing with the river is not just the fishing. It's like the first time I really went out on the river on the kayak, you know, just being out there on a kayak, it's just so much. There's so much more to it than just fishing. Like it felt more like an adventure out there than it was.
It is. I mean, it's been said there's so many great little poetic things that people say about a river, like you never step into the same water twice, right? Which is true because it's never at the same level. It's never at the same temperature. It's never the same time of year. It's always seems to be a different place. And
you got to get out and like pull the kayak up through some riffles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's just awesome to me.
Well, and just like you said, the first time I think I was coming down current and had it spin me around into an eddy, and it just that feeling of like, wow, the current is just ripping me along. And then all of a sudden you get pulled into that water and you like it, looking at it from the shore, you'd think it's all rushing right through there. But there's that one little spot.
Where it's a soft spot. And sometimes it's just in the middle of nowhere. You can't see what's stopping the water. And you've got this, you know, this area that just completely stops you. And a lot of times those edges around that is where the fish are because they know it. I mean, let's be honest. I always tell people, if you've ever sat at a school bus stop when you were a kid and you had wind blowing in your face on a winter morning, you always looked about a way to get yourself out of that wind just a little bit to kind of block it. Well, current can be that way with fish, right? If it's not desirable temperatures, they're going to position themselves. And if you consider, current like wind, it kind of gives you an idea of what they're trying to do to step up for it before they get themselves knocked into it. So, I mean, it's a great thing for, it's a great conveyor for food, but it's also fish have to be facing forward into current to breathe. Right. So, you know, 90% of the time, unless the fish are escaping from something or chasing something, they're facing up river. So when I explain that to people that we present the bait down river to them, they kind of get an idea, like you see this little light bulb go on inside them going, oh, they have to be facing upriver. So by presenting it to them, you're not coming over top of their heads, which does work for some applications. But, you know, if you're bouncing this tube right across their noses, you get a better chance to hit them across the noses when you're throwing it and allowing it to go downriver versus, you know, throwing it over top of their heads.
Hey, you are talking about the current pulling you into eddies and stuff. I don't know. The current just pulls me into laid over trees.
It's the strainers.
Yeah, I had my encounter.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's not easy.
Well, cool, man. I guess we're wrapping up. Did you have anything else, Sean?
For right now, I think we covered a ton. We'll let people digest that, but I think that was pretty good for one sitting here. So
super. Yeah. Well, hey guys, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. If you ever have an open spot or you have any questions or there's anything else I can help you with, please feel free to give me a chat and I'd love to come back on again.
Yeah. Appreciate you coming on here and everything. You want to shout out any social media where people can follow you, find you, any
sure,
it's, you may it's, have, all that?
Yep, you can look us up on Real River Adventures. Our webpage is up, but it doesn't get as much activity as our Facebook page. So it's Real River Adventures-RRA, the initials, and it's real as in R-E-E-L, as in a fishing reel. So Real River Adventures-RRA. And that's on Facebook, and you'll get literally get daily reports if we're doing specials, if we're doing techniques. We're going to be doing a little bit more video on how to present some stuff. I'm working with a group of guys who are in the smallmouth fanatic groups or smallmouth bass groups that want to do more technique type stuff that we're going to be doing some live video. And but you'll be able to follow that on that. And from there, you can link to our Instagram. That's really the best place to go is Facebook right now. That's where we do most of our reports and it's pretty live. And if you do have a question on this, feel free to PM me. I'll answer a question, say, hey, I saw you guys on this and I have a question on something specific, or we fish the Susquehanna a lot. You know, can you tell me about this area? I don't mind getting back. Just realize that it may take me a day or so because I'm literally on the water Monday through Friday. And I try not to fish too much on the weekends and let everybody else have the water.
Cool. Any sponsors?
You know what? Sponsors are I like local sponsors. So one of my favorite sponsors is Fit Premium Lures. There's sponsors that I don't have that I really like to use. I mean, I do like Kitech. I'm on their piece as well. But as far as reels and things like that, I mean, I like Shimano, I like Daiwa, I like Luz, and I'm associated with a few of them. But it wouldn't stop me from using what works best. I mean, that's one of the things that's bad about sponsors is that you tend to drink the Kool-Aid from your side of things. And to me, it's the saving of $15 or $20 isn't worth, you know, not fishing the best equipment. So while I do love, you know, my Daiwa reels, I'm not going to turn down a Shimano reel or a Badmouth something because they're great products, right? So I think that we get too carried away with sponsors at times. So I can do without my sponsors. I want to make sure that I'm giving my clients the best I possibly can. So if it's Kitech and I do get a great deal with Kitech, I love throwing Kitech, but I'm not associated with Z-Man. I have no problem throwing a Z-Man product. You know what I'm saying? So I think if it's working for you and you should be throwing it, not toting a line for something because it's all about catching for me. But thanks for asking.
Yeah. Well, once again, appreciate you coming on here. You know, it's been a good talk. And like Sean said, we'll have to get you back on here sometime because, like I said,
you
river guys, you know,
we're a special breed.
Yeah, you can get more and more information all the time. But yeah, guys, appreciate everybody listening. When this airs, the first Paddle and Fin tournament, the Open on Dale Hollow and the Clash of Clubs will be over with. So that's pretty exciting. Go ahead and say congratulations to all the winners there, whoever they may end up being. Yeah, that's pretty exciting for that first event coming up. Other than that, you know, it's been Bass Fishing for Noobs on the Paddle and Fin podcast, bringing you the techniques, tricks, and tips to help you rip more lips. Later, y'all.
Take care, guys.
Thanks for tuning in to another killer episode on Paddle and Fin. Don't forget to go check out our website at paddlenfin.com. Don't forget to check out the YouTube channel at Paddle and Fin. If you got a question, comment, want to hear from a future guest on a future episode, feel free to email us at paddlenfin@gmail.com. Don't forget to follow us on social media at Paddle and Fin on Facebook and Instagram. Shout out to our show supporters, Angler. The Angler button and app just makes for a better time on the water and creates a virtual logbook for every fishing outing out on the water. Shout out to Rocktown Adventures, located in Northern Illinois, for all your kayaking, camping, and hiking needs. Shout out to Jigmasters Jigs. When in doubt, get the jig out. Go to jigmasters.com.